He said these words to a group of masked men carrying AK-47s. He insisted on getting his laptop back in 5 hours, as if he had a conference call at 7 he couldn't miss. Stranger still, the man agreed.
Okay, the leader said. And we need your phones, too.
Mokhtar, Ahmed, and Sadiq handed over their phones. The men took them and left the room. Ahmed got up and locked the door.
What the hell is that?
He asked.
You told them you need your laptop back by 7? You want us killed?
In the dark, Ahmed, Sadiq, and Mokhtar speculated about who the men were. They contemplated an escape, but there was only one exit, guarded by either this team or the original popular committee.
Let's sleep, Mokhtar said.
He was tired and had the strange sense that he would sleep, and that at 7 there would be a knock on the door with one of the gunmen returning his laptop. Instead, they came at 5 a.m. Mokhtar felt someone nudge him on the shoulder. He opened his eyes and saw his laptop being returned by one of the masked men. He told the man to put it on the floor. The man obeyed, and Mokhtar went back to sleep. In the morning, Mokhtar woke with the rising sun and opened his laptop. It worked, and all seemed unchanged, except the background screen had been altered. It had an image of a mountain village in Haraz. Now it was a picture of one of Mokhtar's flyers for a coffee event he'd held in Oakland. His captors didn't seem to have touched anything else. The only explanation he could conjure was that the popular committee men didn't know how to use Macs. No one he'd ever met in Yemen could use a Mac. These men had tinkered with the computer long enough to do only one thing, change the background screen. He went downstairs. The lobby was dark. The exit was blocked by a roll-down door. They were locked in. The man behind the front desk was asleep in his chair. From the front desk phone, Mokhtar called Abdul Wasser, the bearded man who had helped free them from the police station. Mokhtar assumed he knew the situation.
"We need to leave," Mokhtar said. "Where are our phones?"
Abdul sounded troubled.
"Are you alone?"
he asked. Mokhtar confirmed that he was.
"There are the concerns about your friend, Sadiq. They found some troubling names on his phone. The men wanted to take you all last night, but I convinced them not to."
Abdul told Mokhtar to stay at the hotel. He arrived a few minutes later and informed Mokhtar that his own phone would be returned soon, but on Sadiq's phone, they found numbers of high-ranking Houthis and Houthi collaborators in the Yemeni army. The popular committee planned to take Sadiq for further questioning. Mokhtar assumed he would be tortured. Mokhtar went back to the room and confronted Sadiq. Sadiq was blasé.
"It's my cousin's phone. I don't know any Houthi generals."
Mokhtar asked why there were names of Houthi and Yemeni army generals in his cousin's phone. Sadiq said his cousin had a delivery service truck and a wide range of clients, hotels and schools, some military bases. Mokhtar believed him. Sadiq was not some revolutionary. They'd entered a hotel in a war zone, and he'd asked for an ocean view. Mokhtar went downstairs and explained this to Abdul. "It's not possible that Sadiq is some operative for the Houthi forces. You saw him, right?" Abdul allowed Mokhtar to use his phone. Mokhtar called Ali, back in Sana'a.
"You're alive," Ali said. "Good. Andrew's already talking to the girl, to Sama."
"Sama?"
Ali explained, and Mokhtar put it together. The popular committee men had taken Mokhtar's phone last night, and as they were going through the phones, Andrew called Mokhtar. Not knowing how to use an iPhone, the popular committee men had tried to stop the ringing, but had inadvertently answered the phone and left it connected. Andrew was able to hear about 2 hours' worth of conversations between the men of the popular committee. What he'd heard was disturbing. Mokhtar and his friends were in grave danger. Andrew and Ali spent the night making phone calls. They found Summer's name, called her, and she made calls until she found where Mokhtar was being held and by whom.
"Now it'll be okay," Ali told Mokhtar. "We have all kinds of people talking now. We'll make sure you're safe. Summer's family knows everyone in Aden."
Buoyed by new hope, Mokhtar went back up to the room. He showered, trying to wash the dirt from his feet. He'd been barefoot in the filthy cell the day before. That seemed so long ago now. Alone for the first time in a day, as the water fell around him, he thought through the options. Sadiq was now a suspected Houthi operative who had infiltrated Aden, presumably to report enemy positions and capabilities back to his superiors. The popular committees defending Aden were justifiably paranoid about anyone within the city. especially a Houthi who had seen one of their strongholds in the police station. Mokhtar didn't know what to believe or do. If Sadiq was a Houthi, could Mokhtar continue to defend him? Was it time to distance himself from Sadiq? And what about Ahmed? Was he complicit? Sadiq had taken the only towel, so Mokhtar used the linen shower curtain to dry himself. When he walked out of the bathroom, he saw other Mokhtar. He was with six armed men.
"We're getting you guys out of here," he said.
Other Mokhtar had been called by Summer.
"You have to leave the city now," he said.
Why this man was risking so much for Mokhtar, Ahmed, and Sadiq was unclear. But Mokhtar couldn't question it. They were almost free. Then Mokhtar's mouth opened and said something that, in the moment, was absurd to all in the room.
"My samples! They're in a black Samsonite. I can't leave without them!"
Other Mokhtar winced.
"Your what?"
Mokhtar told the story of his coffee beans, the conference in Seattle.
"It's my whole life," Mokhtar said. "Stay here,"
Other Mokhtar said. He and the six armed men left.
"Are you serious?" Ahmed said. "We have a chance to leave now, and we're staying for your beans?"
An hour went by. 2 hours. Mokhtar, Sadiq, and Ahmed watched the war on television. None of them knew the geography of Aden well, but it looked from the reports as if the fighting was all around them. Mentions of Houthis on the news gave Mokhtar a thought. He looked at Sadiq.
"We have to fix you."
Mokhtar had an extra dress shirt and gave it to Sadiq. Sadiq put it on. The transformation was profound, but not finished. Mokhtar gave him glasses and combed his hair so it looked orderly.
"That's incredible," Ahmed said, looking at Mokhtar.
"He looks like you."
Sadiq looked like a global businessman. Tidy blue dress shirt, spectacles, hair parted neatly on the side. Instantly, Mokhtar thought any threat had disappeared. Why hadn't he done this in Sana'a before the journey? Too many of his best ideas occurred far after they would have been most useful. A knock thundered through the room. It was Other Mokhtar.
"I've got your suitcase. Let's go."
Outside, Mokhtar saw the truck, the suitcase in the back.
"I have to stay with my hotel,"
Other Mokhtar said.
"But my friend here will go along with you."
He introduced them to a man named Ramzi.
"If anyone asks who you are," Other Mokhtar said, "you're part of a water treatment company in Aden, and you're leaving."
Ahmed started the truck. Mokhtar thanked Other Mokhtar. He owed his life to this man he would never see again. Ahmed pulled away. There were three checkpoints before they were clear of Aden, and Ramzi talked them through each. They dropped off Ramzi 10 miles out of Aden. After that, the roads were clear. They sped the 9 hours back to Sana'a unimpeded and arrived that night. Chapter 37. The Port of Mocha. Sitting in Mohammed and Kenza's apartment, Mokhtar weighed his options. In the Popular Committee prison, he heard a guard talking about freighters shipping livestock and people between Mocha and Djibouti City. Online, Mokhtar found that the port of Mocha was more or less functioning. It had been bombed by the Saudis repeatedly, and when it wasn't being bombed, it was being fought over by the Houthi and government forces. But ships were leaving regularly. He called Andrew.
"You want to take a boat from Mocha?" he asked.
"We'll get to Djibouti and fly to Addis," Mokhtar said.
This time, Andrew agreed. The Aden trip hadn't appealed to him, because Aden was an active war zone, and because he'd been holding out hope that a more practical solution would present itself, that the airport might reopen, for example. But that hadn't happened, and now the SCAA conference was fast approaching. Andrew counted on the conference for a good portion of Rayan's yearly sales. He had to be there. Mokhtar called the U.S. Embassy in Djibouti, expecting nothing, but reached a human. He asked, hypothetically, if he and another American were to get passage across the Red Sea and were able to make it to Djibouti by boat, would they be received by the U.S. Embassy and helped in their return to America? The embassy representative, a friendly woman whose pragmatism was emboldening, confirmed they would.
"We won't be put in some refugee camp?" Mokhtar asked.
"No, no," the woman said. "If you make it here, we'll help you in any way we can." Mokhtar and Andrew decided they'd go on Friday, after Juma. Violence was less likely on the Islamic holy day, they assumed. Ahmed agreed to go again, just 2 days after he had narrowly escaped Aden with his life. Mukhtar was humbled. He barely knew Ahmed a week ago, and now he was risking his life again for what? For Mukhtar and Andrew and coffee?
We'll be okay, Mukhtar told him.
Through friends in Sana'a, he'd been connected with a man named Mahmoud, who knew the movements of ships leaving Mocha. Mahmoud assured Mukhtar that he'd take care of the details in getting them on the boat and out of Mocha.
No problem, Mahmoud said.
In the morning, Ahmed arrived at Mokhtar's door, driving a pickup. Mukhtar threw his suitcases in the truck bed. They drove across the city to pick up Ali and Andrew. Andrew came downstairs dressed for Friday prayers, wearing cologne and carrying 5 suitcases full of coffee beans and a basket of Jennifer's muffins. They took off, and Andrew showed Mukhtar and Ahmed a video on his phone of his daughter, Rayanne. She'd been named after his coffee mill. She was 2 years old and, in the video, was talking about strawberries.
Why'd you have to do that? Mukhtar said. He didn't want to be thinking about Andrew's daughter when they were driving to Mocha. He wanted to be thinking about prosaic things. Seattle. Beans.
Goodbye, Sana'a, Mukhtar thought. He was sure it would be there when he returned. He had no idea when. But there was also the possibility it would be radically altered again. There was no guarantee what the Saudis would do, what the Houthis would do. Yemen could become Syria. They drove west, to the Haraz Mountains. The road was narrow and winding, taking them as high as 3,000 meters above sea level. The checkpoints came every 10 or 20 miles, but with Ahmed doing the talking, the Houthis allowed them speedy passage. They made it to Hodeidah and joined the north-south highway. They'd encountered no resistance in the 4 hours they'd been on the road. The highway was 20 miles inland from the coast and traversed a high, flat plain. There were 4 lanes most of the way, and the checkpoints were infrequent and efficient. They arrived in Mocha by early evening. Mukhtar had read about Mocha, and had named his company after Mocha, and had for years been enthralled with its history. But this was his first time seeing it. The road into the town was potholed and surrounded by crumbling stone dwellings, many abandoned. The fabled port had once been one of the most important in the world, but all that remained were some 15,000 impoverished souls. The city had fallen on hard times. There was one functioning hotel in the city. When Mukhtar, Andrew, and Ali walked in, they found a chaotic scene. Everyone who wanted to get out of Yemen through Mocha was there. Ethiopians, Eritreans, Somalis. At the front desk, the clerk was charging about 5 times what a room would have cost on a normal day. But they had no choice. They paid their money and went to their room. Mukhtar called Mahmoud, who said he could arrange passage on a ship the next day. He arrived at the hotel an hour later and confirmed they could take a Somali cargo ship that usually brought livestock to Mocha, but had recently been converted to take humans out of Yemen. The next day, he said, or maybe Sunday, he amended, the ship would take 150 people and a few tons of onions. He'd make sure they had room for Mukhtar and Andrew. The trip to Djibouti City would take anywhere from 15 to 20 hours. Andrew was worried. There was no guarantee of leaving the next day, and no certainty about when they would arrive. The math was bad for their roasting schedule. If they didn't leave the next day, on Saturday, they wouldn't get out of Djibouti the next day. And that meant they wouldn't make the 10 p.m. flight out of Addis Ababa, and that meant they wouldn't get back to the United States in time to roast their coffee. Their coffee had to be roasted and rested to be good, and if it wasn't good, there was no point in any of this. "So we leave tomorrow," Mukhtar said. They ate dinner in the hotel and turned in early. Chewing cot in their room, they heard the roar of 3 diesel buses pulling up. Through the window, they saw dozens of Somalis disembark. Mukhtar assumed they would be on their ship the next day, too. Everyone in the city appeared desperate to leave.
"We could see the Al-Shadli Mosque tomorrow," Mukhtar suggested.
He'd been thinking about it all day. It was the spiritual home of the original monk of Mocha, Sheikh Ali ibn Omar al-Qureshi al-Shadli, the man who first brewed coffee, who built the coffee trade. Andrew looked at Mukhtar like he'd lost his mind.
"We're not going to a mosque tomorrow," he said. "We're not on vacation. We're getting out of here."
They woke at sunrise and contacted Mahmud.
There's a problem, he said.
And Mokhtar knew the rest. Nothing was simple in Yemen. If someone said they could get you on a boat, that was just the beginning of the conversation. It was never as easy as buying a ticket and getting on that boat. Mahmud was saying there was no fuel and the ship wasn't leaving that day.
When is it leaving? Mokhtar asked.
Hard to say, Mahmud said.
Mokhtar asked Mahmud about other possibilities. Mahmud mentioned the outside chance of hiring what he called a viper boat. On it, the trip would take 5 to 6 hours to Djibouti, he said. Mokhtar pictured a speedboat, the sort favored by Caribbean drug dealers.
I'll look into it, Mahmud said.
Mokhtar knew what that meant. He had time. His guide was a local judge and historian, Adel Fada. Short and middle-aged, with a gentle demeanor, he led Mokhtar into the mosque, a humble structure undergoing significant repairs. They walked under the scaffolding as morning light streamed through the high windows. Built to honor Sheikh Ali ibn Omar al-Qureshi al-Shadli, the mosque retained a vibrating spirituality. Al-Shadli, a Sufi monk, had gone to Harar, married an Ethiopian woman, and brought the coffee plant, which hadn't been cultivated yet, it was still wild, back to Yemen. Here, in Mocha, he invented the dark brew now known as coffee. Local lore had it that it was Al-Shadli who was responsible for Mocha's ascendance to the center of the coffee trade. It was he who introduced coffee to traders who came to Mocha and who extolled its medicinal qualities. The mosque was over 500 years old and had been repaired many times, Adel Fata explained. But there was so little money to keep it up now. With Mocha so poor and the country at war, he feared for the future of the mosque and the town.
We can restore this port to greatness, Mokhtar said. If he could get out of Yemen alive and come back someday, he would see to it, he said.
He had no idea how he would do it, but he felt obligated to give the judge some semblance of hope. Adel, a guileless man, listened intently, and Mokhtar realized that all the workers in the mosque were listening too. He spoke about the modern coffee trade, the rise of specialty coffee, the imminent supremacy of Yemeni coffee, how Mocha could thrive again. Mokhtar's phone rang. It was Mahmud. He'd found a boat. At the hotel, it turned out Mahmud hadn't found a boat. They drove around the town, asking anyone they met about the possibility of renting a fishing vessel, a Zodiac, anything. Finally, Mahmud called. He'd found a boat and a captain who could make the trip. Ali drove them to the shore. The pilot was a young man, about 30, and the boat itself was tiny, about 14 feet long, just a flat-hulled skiff. This was no viper boat. It turned out Mahmud had been trying to say fiber boat, not viper boat. Their escape vessel was a sorry thing, low and narrow, with a single sorry Yamaha outboard. It looked like it could be capsized by a tuna.
We'll get soaked in that thing, Andrew noted.
They got back into the truck, looking for tarpaulins. They'd have to wrap the suitcases in the tarps and set them on the bottom of the boat to keep the coffee dry. It was agreed that Ahmed would stay behind and go to the Port Authority to get Mokhtar's and Andrew's passports stamped. They split up. Ali drove them back into town, where Mokhtar and Andrew found a shop that sold tarps. They bought three and turned back to the beach. The truck, though, was low on gas, so they stopped to fill the tank. Sitting in the truck, they heard the rattle of gunfire coming from the waterfront, less than a mile away.
Call Ahmed, Mokhtar said.
Andrew called. Ahmed's phone rang inside the truck. He'd left it behind. Mahmud's Ford Taurus appeared. He tore into the parking lot and jumped out. There'd been a gunfight at the Port Authority, he said. He and Ahmed had been getting the passports stamped when the Houthis started shooting at the Port Authority security officers. Or the security officers started shooting at the Houthis. It was chaos. Mahmud and Ahmed had gotten separated. Mokhtar and Andrew were paralyzed. They needed to find Ahmed, but going to the waterfront seemed suicidal, and he wouldn't be there anymore anyway. He would have fled.
The hotel, Mokhtar said.
They were silent in the truck as Ali sped through the wide streets of Mocha. Mokhtar had the distinct feeling that Ahmed was dead. He couldn't have gotten lucky again. He'd made it through all that mess in Aden, but this was one crisis too many. Andrew saw Mokhtar's face.
Don't worry, he said. He's fine.
They pulled into the hotel and jumped out. Ahmed was standing in the lobby, unscathed.
Hey,
he said. Mokhtar threw his arms around him. Ahmed laughed.
I'm fine. It was nothing.
Mokhtar pulled back and looked at him. Minutes before, he'd been sure that Ahmed was gone. Now, Ahmed was alive, and he had their passports. When the shooting began, he'd hidden the passports in his shirt and had slipped out of the building and into the parking lot, where he ran through the crossfire until he saw a passing motorcycle. He flagged it down, hopped on, and directed the driver to the hotel. Now he presented the passports to Mokhtar and Andrew as if he'd just performed some rudimentary act of processing. He'd had them stamped before the fighting broke out.
You better go now, he said.
They got back into Ali's truck and made their way to another part of the shore. The skiff they'd hired was far from the fighting. At the beach, they were met by a pair of local police officers whose allegiance, the Houthis or the government, was unclear. Mokhtar pressed a bribe into their hands, and they were free to leave Mocha. When they looked closer at the hired skiff, Andrew and Mokhtar laughed. Andrew had grown up on a lake in Louisiana, and this watercraft was smaller than the boats he'd used to go fishing. Could it really make it across the Red Sea? The man they'd hired to steer it seemed confident enough. He said he'd done it many times. There was no extra motor. There was one paddle. There were no life vests. They had no idea if there were Saudi ships out there, or Saudi planes would attack a craft leaving the port, or if the American Navy was out there and might assume they were terrorists and blow them out of the water. There was also the possibility, probably greater than any other, that the captain would sell them to Somali pirates.
Time to leave, Mokhtar said.
They rolled the suitcases in the tarps and set them on the floor of the boat. Between them, they had 100 kilos of green beans. While the captain was prepping the engine, Mokhtar, Andrew, Ali, and Ahmed made a plan for any eventualities. Mokhtar and Andrew would call Ali and Ahmed when they got to the port of Djibouti, or within 24 hours. Before that time, Ali and Ahmed were to stay in Mocha. If Mokhtar and Andrew didn't call within that time, that meant something had gone wrong, that they'd likely been sold to pirates. In that case, Ali and Ahmed were authorized to kidnap relatives of the captain. It was the Yemeni way. On the beach, all of this was discussed with a mixture of seriousness and dark humor. Their suitcases lined the boat floor, and everything was ready. All this time, though, as they prepped the boat and discussed eventualities, two small local kids, a boy and a girl, had been hovering. This wasn't unusual in itself. There were always local kids who took an interest in any vessel leaving the shore. But now these two kids jumped into the boat.
Who are these kids? Mokhtar asked the captain.
They were the children of a friend of his, the captain said. He was delivering them to their father in Djibouti. Mokhtar and Andrew briefly debated whether the presence of two children made the trip more perilous or less so.
Let's go, Andrew said.
They said goodbye to Ali and Ahmed. Ali, who had reassured Andrew and Mokhtar with his explanations of collateral and possible retribution for anything that might befall them, now seemed strangely unsure.
So you're really going? He asked.
We have to get to Seattle, Andrew said.
Call from the boat, Ali said.
They helped the captain push the skiff into shallow water. The captain got in and took his position at the outboard motor.
You know what? I've never been in a boat, Mokhtar said.
You've never been in a boat like this? Andrew asked.
Never been in any boat, Mokhtar said.
Mokhtar had grown up in San Francisco, surrounded by water. Oceans and bays and rivers, estuaries and lakes. He'd spent years in Yemen, a country with a 1,200-mile coast. He'd gone to middle school on Treasure Island, an actual island. But he'd never been on a boat. He'd always wanted to. But the ferries and yachts and sailboats he'd seen throughout his youth seemed part of some unattainable other world. His first experience with any watercraft was going to be in a tiny skiff leaving Yemen in the middle of a civil war. He stepped in, and they left the shore. They were carrying the first coffee to leave the port of Mocha in 80 years. Chapter 38. Djibouti welcomes you. The waves sent them to the floor. They recovered and laughed and braced themselves. The boat, so small and stiff, made every ripple calamitous. They were soaked in minutes. The children were soaked too. They huddled together in the middle of the boat and said nothing for 3 hours. As the shore disappeared behind them, Andrew took a bag of cot out of his backpack.
Really?
Mokhtar said. Andrew smiled. Cot would calm them. Cot would make the ride seem routine. They chewed, and the cot brought them to a state of contentment and philosophy, even while the water and wind demanded they yell over the noise. After the first hour, the sea calmed, and the cot kicked in. And because the sun was shining, and their trust in the captain was growing with every passing mile, they relaxed into complacency. Mokhtar and Andrew, huddled in the middle of the boat, sitting on their samples, found themselves engaged in a ludicrous string of philosophical conversations, the kinds of things people talk about only while on cot, and maybe only while on the sea, on cot, between a war zone and an unknown coast. They talked about God, and Mokhtar heard himself say, "If you believe there's only one path to God, then you're limiting God," and thought he was saying something so profound it might forever change their lives. They talked about practical matters, too, about their coffee work, their farms and farmers and plans, because they felt they were making it safely across the Red Sea, and they knew that hundreds of others wanted to leave Yemen but couldn't. They conjured a plan where, if they made it to Djibouti safely, they would charter a boat that could hold 250 or so, and they'd ferry Yemenis and Americans and anyone else across the Red Sea, doing the work the U.S. State Department couldn't or wouldn't do. They'd call it Operation Arabian Mocha. They were utterly certain this would happen. They made their way south by southwest until they hit the Bab el-Mandeb, a narrow strait where the sea bottlenecked between northern Djibouti and southern Yemen. The gulf grew choppy and the wind picked up. They spent an hour wondering how wet they could get and how much water the boat could take, how likely it was their samples would take in at least some of the sea. But soon, the Djiboutian coast came into view, desolate and gray. They hugged the coast for the next few hours as night came on. They passed the occasional fishermen, saw the distant lights of aircraft overhead. Night claimed the sky, and they motored through black water. The first Djiboutian port they encountered was Obok, a tiny town on the easternmost point of the coast, and by no means the place where they intended to disembark. There was no U.S. embassy there, and few, if any, services. They had no desire to stop. But the captain was stopping.
"Just a minute," the captain said.
He had to drop the kids off. Obok was an entry point for Yemeni refugees, he said. There was a United Nations refugee camp nearby. He intended to deposit the kids there, and they'd be on their way. But this sounded wrong. Mokhtar's tenderloin senses were now on high alert. They'd spent 5 hours growing increasingly complacent about the captain, and now there was this. This, a sudden, unannounced change of plans, was exactly the kind of thing they'd feared. But the captain's behavior was so nonchalant that they found themselves allowing him to approach the docks. Mokhtar hoped for a 5-minute turnaround. The boy and girl would climb off, the boat would shove off. He didn't expect to see anyone in uniform, but now there were 2 men on the dock, and the captain was throwing them a line.
"What are we doing?" Mokhtar asked the captain.
"Just dropping off the kids," he said.
"Don't worry."
Now the men in uniform beckoned Mokhtar and Andrew to disembark.
"Who are these guys?" Andrew muttered.
Mokhtar had no idea. Coast Guard? Local police? They were wearing blue camouflage and carrying German G3 rifles.
"Where are you coming from?"
one of the officers asked.
"Yemen,"
the captain said.
"And these two?"
the officer asked, indicating Mokhtar and Andrew. The captain told them they were Americans stopping briefly on their way to the capital, where they were expected by the embassy. Now the officers were very interested.
"You're different than the ones that came before,"
one of them said.
"What do you mean?"
Mokhtar asked.
"The Americans that came before you. They had people from the U.S. government pick them up. Why don't you have anyone here receiving you?"
"Because we're headed for Djibouti City,"
Mokhtar said.
"We had no plan to stop in Obok."
"Come with us,"
one of the guards said.
"The governor will want to meet you."
Grim possibilities ran through Mokhtar's mind. Secret prisons. Illegal detentions. This could be a CIA black site. Since 9/11, Djibouti had been a significant U.S. counterterrorism partner. It was the launch point for the drone fleet that routinely bombed Yemen, and terrorism suspects had been detained, interrogated, and tortured in Djibouti for years. He was thankful for the presence of Andrew, a white American. They wouldn't disappear a man like Andrew. The captain had turned off the engine, and the kids were on the dock, and the Djiboutian men in uniform were welcoming Mokhtar and Andrew with wide smiles. Mokhtar looked to Andrew. Nothing good could come of this. But because refusing seemed more fraught than accepting the governor's hospitality, Mokhtar and Andrew allowed themselves to be helped out of the boat, and soon their suitcases were out of the boat, too, and were being opened and inspected. Suitcases full of small plastic bags. It looked like drugs. Mokhtar and Andrew had to explain their samples, their work in coffee, their schedule, their need to get back in the boat and get going, the conference in Seattle. But getting there on time now seemed unlikely. They were being detained. Not in a hostile way, not in a way that felt especially menacing, not yet at least. It was more like the disorganized and irrational detentions common at American airports, the kind of detention that came from the officers feeling they'd been confronted with something beyond their immediate comprehension, something too unusual to simply allow. Mokhtar and Andrew found themselves in the back of an SUV, being driven to what they had been told would be the governor's home.
"You think that's where we're going?"
Andrew whispered.
"I don't know," Mokhtar said,
while thinking it was brilliant, really, for the Djiboutians to tell them they were being taken to a governor's house. The prospect of being honored this way was meant to make them complacent. And where was the captain of their boat now? He was gone. The children were gone. This heightened the likelihood that the captain had somehow arranged their sale or transfer. The kids were a decoy. Mokhtar's mind was a jumble of dark-hearted possibilities. The SUV pulled up in front of what looked to be a house, not a prison. The officers opened the car doors, and Mokhtar and Andrew were led to the front door, where a smiling Djiboutian man, wearing khakis and a button-down shirt, walked out and greeted them.
"Hello, hello," he said, then turned to an aide. "Water? Can we get you some water?"
he asked, leading them inside. They accepted warm bottled water. It was easily 110 degrees in Obok, and the humidity was stifling. The governor led them to his office, a spacious wood-paneled room with a view of the sea. He asked about their trip and their plans, and Mokhtar and Andrew told them how they'd hoped to go straight to the capital and from there catch the earliest flight to Addis.
"Oh, you won't make that flight,"
the governor said cheerfully. It was already 8 o'clock, and by boat the trip was a few hours, he said. And besides, they had much clarifying to do. The governor would have to talk to the U.S. Embassy in the capital and let them know about all this, the unannounced arrival of two Americans in Yemeni dress.
"Spend the night here," the governor said. "We have a very nice tourist hotel. You'll stay."
They were not being given a choice. For the night, at least, they would be the paying prisoners of the local Djiboutian authorities. This was the second time in a week that Mokhtar had been forced to fund his own detention. The governor told them that authorities from the U.S. Embassy would have to approve their release, or would have to come and retrieve them. Then he said his goodbyes, telling them he would see them the next day. Mokhtar knew it was a 6-hour drive to the capital, where the embassy was. No one from the embassy would make the drive to Obok. And none of it made any sense anyway, because all they had to do was get back into the boat and make the 2-hour water trip to the capital. Guards took Mokhtar and Andrew to the hotel, an array of adobe huts on a cliff above the ocean. The guards waited with them as they checked in. Once they paid, in U.S. dollars, the guards left. The rooms were spare. Each had a cot, an end table, and a fan overhead. They were not guarded. They could, if they wanted to challenge the Djiboutian authorities, try to leave the hotel compound, find the road, and try to hitchhike to the capital. Or they could take their chances at the waterfront, find the captain, sneak away by sea. Neither was possible. There were too many unknowns, and the guards in their blue camouflage were likely at the waterfront. And the town was dark and desolate. There were no cars moving, no people on the streets. It was a broken-down town with a sinister air. People could disappear in a place like this. Andrew tried his phone and found he had coverage. He called Jennifer and told her where they were. She found the number for the U.S. Embassy in Djibouti City. He called, and in his most charming southern drawl, he told the woman what had happened. She promised him hospitality and safe passage once they got to Djibouti City. They had no choice but to wait till morning. At breakfast, there was a bizarre tableau of people in the tiny hotel restaurant, a group of mismatched army officers from North Africa, an Italian family, the parents, perhaps aid workers, whispered while their child watched cartoons on an iPad. Strangest of all was a table full of nuns, chatting amiably and seeming excited to be in Djibouti, where the temperature was now 115. Mokhtar and Andrew ate in numb silence. After eating, they took a taxi to the governor's office, where the guards told them they could take the regular commuter ferry from Obok to the capital.
"When does the ferry leave?" Mokhtar asked.
The guards weren't sure. It often left at 12:30, they said, but that schedule wasn't dependable. In fact, they said, the ferry might not run at all that day. Andrew grew agitated and reminded Mokhtar of their timetable. They needed to be back. The beans needed to be roasted. Then they needed rest. Mokhtar and Andrew came at the officials from both sides. Andrew played the demanding American, while Mokhtar spoke in more conciliatory tones. When this didn't work, they switched places and tried again. Finally, it became clear that the officials couldn't countenance the two Americans getting back onto a random fishing boat and arriving in Djibouti City that way. There would be questions there. And what if they told the officials what had transpired in Obok? Their captors were worried. They never stamped these two Americans in. They had no power to do so, given Obok was not an official port of entry. But at the same time, they couldn't simply let them back onto the water. The problem was the means of passage. Mokhtar and Andrew weren't going to be allowed to get back on a boat, any boat, so they offered an alternative. They would rent a truck and hire a driver, and they would drive to the capital. The officials accepted this alternative, and soon they had secured an SUV and hired a driver, loaded their samples, and were off. It was 120 degrees, and with the humidity, it felt like double that. The drive took 6 hours, and there was an extra man in the car, a low-level Djiboutian officer who had insisted on coming along, no doubt expecting a bribe once they got to the city. They passed through largely uninhabited landscapes, charred red by drought and relentless heat. They drove along the Djiboutian coast, occasionally cutting inland across parched riverbeds and rust-red valleys. All the while, Mokhtar and Andrew discussed, in English, various possibilities and eventualities. They needed to be driven to the U.S. Embassy, and if they made it there, the bribe and the fact of this uninvited official tagging along would no longer be an issue. But they had to make it there. All along, they wondered if this would be as simple as the truck taking them to the capital. What would prevent the Djiboutian official from suggesting a detour, a stopover until the matter of the bribe was worked out? There were checkpoints along the way. The Djiboutian government was trying to control the rising tide of refugees from Yemen. The first two checkpoints were easy and quick. At the third, the officer and their driver were questioned, and Andrew and Mokhtar had to present their passports. Eventually, they were allowed to pass. It was late afternoon when they got to Djibouti City, a dusty city of 529,000, oppressed by the same grievous heat that kept the rest of the country under its boot heel. Mokhtar and Andrew assumed they would be driven to the U.S. Embassy, but instead, they were taken to a police station, where a young officer in stylish civilian clothes — it looked more like a model than a cop — interviewed Mokhtar and Andrew individually about why they were in Djibouti and how they got there. While Mokhtar was giving his statement, Andrew called the U.S. Embassy and spoke to the woman he'd reached the night before, Carol. She said she would send someone to retrieve them. The statements done, the stylish cop said Mokhtar and Andrew were free to go. The official from Obok did not agree. He was still waiting in the lobby. He demanded $200, but he couldn't decide how he would define the fee. It was for his services in guiding them to the capital, he said. When Mokhtar and Andrew didn't buy it, he said it was a processing fee for their arrival in Obok. That didn't work, so he threatened to have them arrested in the police station.
"Can you help us?"
Mokhtar asked the stylish cop. The stylish cop stepped in and sent the official on his way. "I almost feel bad for him," Mokhtar said. The embassy envoy arrived. She was a Djiboutian American from Washington, D.C., and she was so friendly and competent that Mokhtar and Andrew almost hugged her. Still, Mokhtar thought it better to have the Louisianan talk, so he stayed silent, thinking there was a remote chance he'd be detained, sent to Guantanamo. Instead,
She brought them to a travel agent and found a flight leaving the next day that would get them to the U.S. in time for the SCAA conference. It left Djibouti City at 3 a.m. When they got to the airport, the customs officials were flummoxed. Mokhtar and Andrew had never been issued visas to come to Djibouti and never had their passports stamped. Without an entry stamp, the customs officials couldn't give them an exit stamp. In a rare moment of pragmatism in the middle of the night, the customs officials decided to simply let them get on the plane. No stamps. It was as if they'd never been in Djibouti at all. Book 5 Chapter 39 Return to the Infinity Mokhtar's return to the U.S. was a circus. In San Francisco, he was met at the airport by television cameras. He did interviews with local news, NPR, and Al Jazeera. He spent the night at home with his bewildered and grateful family. And the next day, he flew to Seattle, where the Specialty Coffee Association of America conference was an unbounded success. Mokhtar gave a keynote speech. The audience stood and applauded. And he and Andrew shared a booth introducing Yemeni coffee to the specialty world. After the conference, Mokhtar was in a taxi on his way to the airport when he heard his own voice on the radio. It was an interview he'd done with the BBC. "This guy's crazy," the driver said, not realizing the crazy man was riding in his car. When he and Andrew had hired that boat, they hadn't quite grasped how people back home would see it. They'd left Mocha during multiple firefights, hired a skiff, and crossed the Red Sea, because they didn't want to miss a trade show. Half his friends in the Bay Area thought, at least for a few hours, that he was dead. The day that Mokhtar escaped, another Bay Area Yemeni-American, Jamal al-Labeni, had been killed by mortar fire. Before his name had been released, scraps of information had ricocheted around Mokhtar's network, and his friends had feared the worst. After the conference in San Francisco, Mokhtar was met by Miriam, Justin, and Giuliano, who commented on how put together he looked for someone who had just escaped a war. He was in demand from the Arab American community, from Muslim American advocacy groups, from coffee people. But finally, all that died down and it was back to work. He went to Blue Bottle. James Freeman had heard his story and now cupped his Hema samples. Freeman scored them at 90 plus. "How much of this can you get?" Freeman asked. "A container? 18,000 kilos?" Mokhtar said. Freeman was quiet for a moment. "There might not be enough," he said. He wanted to buy it all. The math was preposterous. If Mokhtar could sell a container's worth of Yemeni coffee to specialty outlets, the profit margin would be significant. His farmers would be making 30% more than what they'd been making before. But he needed capital. Far more capital. He asked Ibrahim if he had ideas. Ibrahim made lists. They had tapped out everyone they knew in the Yemeni American community. They had to look elsewhere. Mokhtar was telling Miriam about all this one day in the mission. Miriam was just glad Mokhtar was alive. After all, she'd been the one to point him toward coffee, and he'd gone to Yemen and almost died. Now he needed money to pay for more coffee, to presumably continue going to Yemen and almost dying. They were at Ritual Coffee Roasters, a cafe on Valencia Street, and were talking about all this, Yemen and its troubles and its coffee, when a woman at the next table took an interest. She was tall, blonde, thin. Her name was Stephanie. "You should come to where I work," she said. Mokhtar didn't know what coming to her work had to do with anything, but then she said she worked at a venture capital firm called Founding Fathers. It sounded intriguing. He called Ibrahim. "Founding Fathers, that's a great name for a VC firm," Ibrahim said. But when they looked online, they found there was no VC firm called Founding Fathers. They looked up Stephanie on Facebook. "Holy shit," Ibrahim said. "She works at Founders Fund." Mokhtar didn't know what that meant. "Is that good?" he asked. Ibrahim educated him. Founders Fund had made early investments in Facebook, Airbnb, and Lyft. They had billions in play. Their imprimatur could make any vague notion real. They told Stephanie they would be happy to come to her work. Then again, they thought, Founders' founder was a man named Peter Thiel, who was most recently known for his appearance at the Republican National Convention, espousing his devotion to Donald J. Trump.
"Can't worry about that yet," Mokhtar said.
Founders was full of progressives, including one of its partners, a woman Stephanie thought they should meet. Her name was Cyan Bannister. They looked her up. She was a noted angel investor who had bet early on SpaceX and Uber. She was also genderqueer.
"We can go," Mokhtar said.
Somehow, her politics, they thought, would balance out Thiel's. Then again, Thiel was gay, too. It was all very confusing. Founders' offices were in the Presidio, a former military base on the northern shore of San Francisco, in a building renovated by George Lucas. There was a full-sized Darth Vader replica in the lobby.
"James Freeman says your coffee tastes like angels singing," Cian said.
She was very kind and very interested, and she'd done her research. There was real money and quality coffee, she knew, and she was emboldened by Blue Bottle's faith in Mokhtar. But, she said, Founders Fund couldn't be a lead investor. They didn't lead early-stage rounds.
"We have a lead investor," Ibrahim said.
This was not strictly true, but Ibrahim had been thinking that if they could get a commitment from Founders Fund, they could leverage that to bring in lead funding from another VC firm, Endure Capital, based in Dubai and run by a friend of Ibrahim's, an Egyptian named Tariq Fahim. They left the Presidio that day with an improbable plan that, a few months later, had been realized. Based on Founders' pledge, they brought in Endure. Based on Endure's commitment, they brought in funds from another firm, 500 Startups. There was suddenly a very real company. They could pay for the coffee to get to the U.S. They could pay their farmers. And they could pay themselves. Mokhtar had a new thought. Now, he might even be able to afford his own apartment. For the time being, he was still sleeping on the floor at his parents' house in Alameda. They'd moved again, and inches from Waleed, whose snoring was an affront to propriety and the enemy of slumber. Mokhtar had a friend who had a friend named Homera, a realtor, so he looked her up in rental listings online. He laughed. He knew, immediately, that he could not afford to rent a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco. But out of grim curiosity, he scrolled through Homera's listings and stopped when he saw one in the Infinity. The pictures were astounding. Views of the bay, all of downtown, Berkeley, Oakland, the Bay Bridge, Angel Island, Marin. In all the time he worked at the Infinity, he'd never been into one of the units. He delivered packages occasionally, helped residents carry things to and from the elevators, brought takeout to their doors, but he'd never been invited inside. The price per month was farcical. He couldn't afford anything. For the hell of it, he went on Craigslist. Again, he saw a listing at the Infinity. This one from someone looking for a roommate to go in on a two-bedroom in the building. Thinking a shared room on short notice might be a subletter's bargain, he emailed the mailbox listed, saying he worked in coffee and was interested. A reply came from someone named Shagun. He looked her up on Facebook and found she was a woman, a very attractive Indian-American woman in medical school. He knew he couldn't cohabitate with her, with any woman he wasn't married to. His parents would collapse, but it couldn't hurt to meet her and see the apartment. For the first time since he left the Infinity, he returned. He was dressed in his Rupert attire and made a point to show up a few minutes late. He didn't want to linger in the lobby in case someone he knew was working at the desk. Shagun didn't need to know he'd been a doorman. When she appeared, she was far too beautiful to live with, so any lingering notions he had about defying Yemeni customs were gone. Also in the lobby was a resident, an older white man, a financial manager named Jim Stauffer. Mokhtar had opened the door for Mr. Stauffer 100 times, received and sorted his packages. Mokhtar's eyes met his, and he assumed Stauffer would come over, ask why he was back, how he was doing. Mokhtar resigned himself to being found out. But Mr. Stauffer tilted his head, like a nearsighted man unsure what he was seeing, turned, and went on his way. Either he couldn't remember Mokhtar's name or didn't recognize him at all. Soon, Mokhtar was alone in the elevator with Shagun, rising through the Infinity to the apartment on the 23rd floor. She talked about medical school, about how she was looking for a roommate who worked, who
who was clean, who wouldn't be a distraction. She didn't say all this in so many words, but Mokhtar understood. He'd opened doors for professionals like this. He knew. Inside the apartment was just like the pictures in the brochures. The light was everywhere. Blue was everywhere. The city and all its glass, it was all inside the apartment. Just standing in that room would take a radical adjustment of one's equilibrium. It was like standing on the wing of a plane. They sat down, and now she asked, gently, the questions Mokhtar assumed she'd had since shaking his hand in the lobby. How does a man your age, working in coffee, afford an apartment like this? Was he heir to some Bahrainian fortune? He told her about Yemen, about dodging bombs and Houthis to get coffee out of the country, about his farmers, how in a few months, God willing, he'd be shipping a container full of the finest coffee in the world out of Yemen and to Oakland, and how he wanted to be in the Infinity, overlooking the bay, when that ship came in. "And I used to work here," he said.
"In the sales office?" she asked.
She didn't believe he'd been a doorman. He rattled off the names of half a dozen lobby ambassadors he knew, a few she might have met, and finally she took him at his word. He knew he couldn't live with her, with any single woman, but now there was a hunger within him. He had to live in the Infinity to prove that he could. 2 weeks later, he found another listing, another sublet, in Infinity B. Apparently, there was a guy named Matt who lived with a guy named Jeff who owned an analytics firm in Berkeley. Matt had to move to Ohio for work but kept the apartment and was subletting his room. His most recent lessee was a Russian business student who was moving out. The price for the one-bedroom sublet was more than Mokhtar had ever spent on anything in the United States. But he had a vision. The vision featured him, Mokhtar Alkanshali, living on the 30th floor, or whatever floor Jeff and Matt lived on, standing on a balcony with everyone he loved, watching his coffee come into port. Mokhtar called Matt, and Matt thought Mokhtar seemed a worthy successor to the Russian oligarch. All Mokhtar had to do was meet Jeff, who would have the final say. Mokhtar walked through the lobby, not recognizing anyone working the front desk, and got into the elevator. On the 33rd floor, Jeff opened the door. A tall white man in his 40s, he offered Mokhtar wine. Mokhtar declined. Jeff poured himself a glass, and they talked about the Russian, about their work schedules. And all the while, Jeff seemed to want to ask the same question Shagun had implied. "Are you some kind of Saudi prince?" When Mokhtar had said he was in coffee, Jeff assumed he was a barista. Eventually, Mokhtar noticed a high-end hand grinder on the counter and found a way to work Blue Bottle into the conversation. Then it was over. Jeff went to Blue Bottle every day. He offered Mokhtar the sublet, and Mokhtar, defying all fiscal responsibility, took it. Stephen offered help with the move, but there wasn't much to contend with. Mokhtar had one suitcase and two garbage bags. They parked around the corner and carried Mokhtar's worldly possessions into the lobby of the Infinity Tower B. A young man, Jonathan, was working the front desk that day. The phone was ringing and the lobby was frantic. Jonathan was supposed to give Mokhtar the key Jeff had left for him, but he couldn't find it. Mokhtar and Stephen waited on the lobby's leather couches.
"You okay?" Stephen asked.
"I'm fine."
"Why?"
Mokhtar said.
"You keep getting up to open the door for people," Stephen said.
Mokhtar had been up and down half a dozen times. He couldn't help it.
"Sorry," he said.
"Force of habit."
"You don't work here anymore,"
Stephen said.
I know,"
Mokhtar said.
A week later, Mokhtar was driving over the Bay Bridge, heading to San Francisco. The city was bright as a chandelier. His father was in the front seat, his mother in back. They'd just eaten dinner out, Mokhtar's treat.
"Remember the Infinity where I used to work?" he asked them.
They remembered.
"They're having an open house tonight," Mokhtar said. "You want to go?"
His parents had two sons who'd worked at the Infinity, so seeing inside one of the towers wasn't without interest, but it was 8 o'clock on a weekday. Why would the building be holding an open house now? There were no other visitors in the lobby,
No signs of an open house. Mokhtar hoped only that his parents would believe a little longer. In the elevator, he pushed 33. He'd arranged it so Jeff would be gone when they arrived. He slipped the key in the slot and opened the door. As always, the city was alive in every window, the candelabra of downtown reflected on the apartment's polished floors.
"There's no one here," his mother said.
Mokhtar brought his mother to the balcony, and they breathed in the air from the bay, from the sky at that height. But his father was still near the doorway.
"He's afraid of heights," his mother said. "You didn't know?"
Mokhtar didn't know. They'd never been higher than the third floor, in their old apartment in the Tenderloin. Mokhtar brought his mother back inside, and by then his father had seen the photographs. Mokhtar had arranged framed photos of his mother and father on the coffee table.
"Why are those here?"
his mother asked. "Mom, Dad, sit down," Mokhtar said. They sat down. "I'm doing really well now," he said. "I'm working hard, and the company's doing well. I want you to be proud of me, and I want to provide for you." He told them about his coffee, about the orders, about the ship coming.
"That's so good, Mokhtar," his mother said. "But I still don't understand why those pictures of us are here."
"Mom," Mokhtar said, "because this is where I live." Chapter 40 Coffee on the Water. Conditions in Yemen were deteriorating. Virtually no goods were being shipped out of the country. Activity at the ports was concentrated on importing essentials. Medicine was scarce, and the vast majority of the country was suffering from food insecurity. The UN considered Yemen on the brink of famine. No one was prioritizing the export of coffee to international specialty roasters. But Mokhtar kept his farmers harvesting. The widow Warda, the general, and the rest of the farmers of Hema continued their work. Their region was nearly untouched by the war, and they continued to ship the red cherries to Mokhtar's warehouse in Sana'a. His sorters came to work every day. With the airstrikes, any power they could get had to come from their own diesel-fed generators. Mokhtar checked in every morning at 4 a.m., California time. He talked with Andrew and Ali to make sure everyone was safe, and he dealt with financial issues and logistics. The problems came from all sides. One day, a sorter was unable to make it to work when a Saudi bomb had cratered the road she needed to take to get to work. Another sorter's husband was being pressured to fight for the Houthis. It had to go into hiding. Then there was the matter of the grain pro bags. That Mokhtar needed the bags at all was good news. They had enough green beans to fill a container, but to transport them by sea, it wasn't enough to put them in traditional burlap sacks. If Mokhtar was to send the message that his coffee would be different and superior, it had to start with the packaging, with ensuring that the coffee arrived without the odor of the sea, of the ship's hold, whatever else it was carrying or had carried. Grain pro bags were the industry standard. Thick plastic bags that kept moisture in and interfering elements out. In the U.S., or virtually any other part of the world, getting hold of grain pro bags would be as easy as a phone call and a visit by UPS. But to get these bags to Yemen, during a war, was beyond the realm of reason. Mokhtar managed to get 1,200 bags shipped to Ethiopia. That took 2 weeks. But no one in Ethiopia could get them to Yemen. He made calls to Djibouti and found a freighter that was making trips between Djibouti City and Mocha. That took another 6 weeks. In all, it was 2 months before he could get the bags to Sana'a. There, the sorted coffee was placed in carefully labeled bags. Sealed, the bags were brought to the port of Aden and were ready to be shipped to Oakland. It was difficult sometimes to see all this as essential. People were dying in Yemen. The country was collapsing, and in his San Francisco high-rise, Mokhtar was waking up every morning at 4 a.m. to call Sana'a about coffee, about when the container could leave Yemen. But there was a lot of money at stake. Omar's money, his investors' money, Hubeishi's money. There was the faith of all his farmers to think about their pickers and his processors. And now Mokhtar had his own staff in San Francisco. He'd hired his old friend, Ibrahim Ahmed Ibrahim, as CFO. Ibrahim's wife, Selua, was being as supportive as she could, given they had a 15-month-old baby and her husband had just quit his well-paying job at Intuit to work with Mokhtar, whose most applicable experience